So this development to network pharmacology will diversify the business models applicable in the pharma industry.
In all of this wonderful science that we have and we know works, a crucial step will be that these new therapies will be fairly reimbursed so that there is a reasonable return on investment. Otherwise, it will not happen.
This is Business Insights, a podcast brought to you by global strategy consultancy Roland Berger.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to the Business Insight podcast of Roland Berger on health. My name is Thilo Kaltenbach. I'm a senior partner with Roland Berger. And my guest today is Professor Harald Schmidt. Harald, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Harald, maybe you're a professor. Maybe you can start a bit to introduce yourself and your research and what you're doing actually, and what is your most important purpose these days and research findings that are helping us maybe to understand a bit better the topic of today, network pharmacology, and how it can dramatically transform the R&D productivity in pharma.
Yeah, I'm a medical doctor and a pharmacist, but I've mainly worked in research in Germany, Australia, the US, and now in the Netherlands. And for most of my career, I've done classical biomedical research, I would say. But since about 10 years, we have entered systems medicine, and that's something completely new.
How did you come across this topic?
Now, actually, chronologically, we have been doing the normal hypothesis-based research. Most research have their favorite disease or their favorite organ or their favorite signal mechanism they work on their whole life. And we also had that. So for our validation experiments, we did a very complicated model, so-called knock-out mouse or knock-in mice, which take a hell of a work, take very long. We had our ideas which phenotypes we would expect in those mice and which diseases we should see in effect, and we didn't. And then I came across a poster from Laszlo Barabasi, who is a network scientist, and he had done really a seminal paper on the network of all human diseases, something that a human brain could never do, and the connections via shared genes, via shared drugs, shared symptoms, comorbidity, and so forth. And then we had sent our mice to different labs. Maybe they see something. And then we got sort of weird results, which I didn't really like. So someone said, oh, here in stroke, there's a huge effect. Or here in diabetes or in kidney disease, there's a strong effect. And I said, and then I wanted to work on hypertension. And I said, what do I do with this? You know, I don't want to work in these areas. And then I looked at this poster. All these diseases where these knockout mice had a phenotype were all in a group of diseases connected through shared risk genes. And then I thought, maybe there is something to it. And basically what has then developed is that we see, apart from rare diseases, which are often named after a gene, or infectious diseases where we really know what we want to treat, the bug or the virus,
yeah,
in most other diseases, we don't really understand the molecular mechanism. For all other diseases, we want to change what we actually call a disease, you know? So a very good example are, again, these rare diseases. They at least have a precise definition, named after a gene very often. But then these diseases or these patients have symptoms in 2, 3, 4, 5 organs. So the simplest form of a disease shows us already that our entire structure of medicine and research, namely by organ, cardiology, cardiologist, cardiovascular research, neurology, neurologist, neuroscience, this whole organ-based approach to disease is wrong. We are working in silos in the clinic, and in research. And as long as we keep doing this, we will achieve close to nothing. But to actually work with this is for a human brain too much. You cannot have in your brain considering all diseases, all risk genes at the same time, make correlations and connections. For this, you need really advanced bioinformatics. And research field behind that is network science. You can, of course, network a lot of stuff, and it's a really fascinating area, social networks, airplane networks, whatever, power grids networks. These are all networks, and they follow amazingly more or less the same mathematical rules. We just use it for medicine. And to say already a promise from the end, it works.
Maybe let's jump back a bit in terms of, you know, where R&D productivity stands today. It seems sometimes that we are stuck a bit in the 1960s. You know, many chronic diseases are not curable. We treat the symptoms, not the root causes. And there's incremental progress rather than revolutionary progress. And, you know, how do you think, you know, what is the reason for that? And how do you think network pharmacology in your research can contribute to a step change?
Yeah, basically, there is this nice graph called E-Room's Law, which is actually a reversal of Moore's Law. Moore's law is basically what caused the IT revolution, that every 2 years, we were able to print 10 times more transistors on the same size of microchips. So that was a constant improvement. In drug discovery and development, it's actually the opposite. That's why they called it E-rooms, you know, the reverse of Moore. We're getting worse and worse and worse. And not only because of tighter regulations and so forth, and it hasn't also improved much with the introduction of biologicals. It's a constant decline in productivity since the 1950s, 60s of the last century. So it's a constant decline. So obviously, there is something conceptually wrong. Initially, there were low-hanging fruits. I mean, in the 50s and 60s, before the thalidomide scandal, you could basically bring any drug to the market, even with circumstantial evidence and so forth. And nowadays, I think the main problem is that we don't understand the molecular cause of most diseases, and we lump diseases together only because they basically share the same symptom. Mm-hmm. So we tend, hypertension is one disease and it has more or less one symptom, or Alzheimer or asthma or inflammatory bowel disease. But there are just symptoms. There may be 10 different disease mechanisms which may cause elevated hypertension. But if I constantly merge everything together, I will always talk about complex diseases. Yeah, they are complex because you have sort of lumped together stuff which actually does not belong together. So we don't see, in German, we say, I don't know if that translates to English, because of the forest, we don't see the trees.
No? Absolutely.
That translates.
And this is absolutely clear. And this is actually, and this is, you know, actually not surprising, right? I mean, why is the medical structures in most of the countries are organized by organs? Because like in the 19th and 20th century, early 20th century, when you know, many of these standardizations have been taking place, and the research was pretty much in terms of, you know, your physiology and what you can see, anatomy, you know, what you can see. Are the organs, and then let's organize it around the organs, and then you see the symptoms, and they also express themselves in certain organs. So there's a specialist for the heart, there's a specialist for the bones, and for the knees. So that's actually, I think, not surprising. And now what you're saying is that research also has developed a lot. And I know since many, many decades already, we understand more and more the molecular mechanisms of the different processes in the human body. And then what you said is that, you know, even with that understanding, it was not possible to understand that complexity of the network. So why can we understand it today? Is it AI? Is it digital? So why can we understand it today? And what happened between, like, when you, before you started the research and now?
AI is not the solution, but it's a powerful tool. AI helps us to do a lot of routine tasks, which otherwise could take months, but AI does not the discovery for us. So the Human Genome Project has certainly achieved a lot for rare diseases, where one gene is identified and is the cause, more or less. But for all other diseases, it hasn't really achieved very much. So there is not only a problem in how we define diseases, it's also a problem on how we do genetics. And basically, what we define as disease mechanism. So it has been sort of the gold standard or holy grail that the industry has one disease, one target, and one drug. So that means by hitting one protein or whatever molecule in a cell, you can treat a disease. What we see, and that actually comes from parallel innovation in signaling research, in complicated technology to measure the composition of proteins within one cell, that the cell is actually organized in little, yeah, we call them modules, other call them protein communities or assemblies. It's always the same. In little groups of proteins, usually about 10 proteins that are lined up like pearls on a string. So any defect that something is not working properly needs to happen in one of these modules. Let's call them modules, which number one says it's very often not going to be just one target. You have to find out what is going wrong in this module. And if a protein appears not only in one type of module, but in several, it makes it even more complicated. So then you need to treat or first understand and then treat all these dysregulations at the different sites of the cell. So it's basically not only a profound new concept for medicine, but it's also a profoundly new approach to genetics and cell biology. So we are challenging a lot of things. And this network pharmacology, which you mentioned, basically summarizes that. So if you need to treat a network, a little module, yeah, you can imagine like if dogs need to herd sheep, it's probably one dog may be able to do it, but two or three dogs probably have it easier to keep, I don't know, 100, 200 sheep under control. So that's why it is a little network, a little signaling network that went banana, is probably easier to treat with one compound there, another compound there, another compound at the bottom. Maybe the two first ones stimulate, another one inhibits a little bit, and thereby we normalize this network. It's a bit unlikely that by hammering it at one side, it will work. So network pharmacology means mechanism-based disease definition, but a mechanism defined as one of these networks, and then you better treat it with two or three compounds, which has as a side effect, so to say, that these compounds are very, very synergistic. So what we observed is that we can reduce the concentration or the dose of each of these compounds much below the doses where they are usually used. So thereby also any potential side effects, even though I combine two or three compounds, the aggregated risk for side effect is lower even if I gave only one compound.
That's exciting. Can you give us a couple of examples where network pharmacology already has helped in better understanding or even treating diseases?
Yeah. So we published this year a paper in something that's called peripheral artery disease, or it's also called claudication, or in Germany we call it Schaufensterkrankheit, so because people walk and they when they get pain in their legs, they stop and they maybe look at some windows in the city, and once the pain is relieved, they keep on walking again. So they stop frequently, or they can only climb one floor at a time, and then, you know, the legs don't get enough blood and they start hurting. And yeah, the thing that I described, look for genes, make modules, thought, is there maybe a treatment that we could use? And it worked. And the other trick that we also do is, very often you hear, oh, breakthrough in this disease, some mechanism identified, and then maybe in 10 or 15 years, there will be a new therapy for patients. That's not really exciting, I would say. So what we do is we always try to find drugs that are on the market already. Yeah, so registered, they're on the market, and we try, can we find drugs for this module, for this protein network that does exactly what we want? So we can go directly into a clinical trial. And in the best cases, basically from the first discovery to clinical proof of concept, maybe 2 years pass by, maybe 2.5 years. So it's an extreme acceleration and, of course, cost reduction in the development process.
I understand. But this is a business podcast, so let's talk business. What does it mean to the pharma pipelines? I mean, it sounds like the pharma companies really need to rethink the way they organize R&D. Is that also...
Yeah, I mean, true. And there are some companies, you know, Patrick Wellens, the former senior vice president R&D from Glaxo, once said in Nature Review Drug Discovery, look, the disease definitions that we have are 19th, 20th century. There is no molecular understanding. I predict, he said, that most diseases will eventually look more like rare disease. And the new CEO from Novartis, well, now he's not so new anymore, when he started, said, you know, those companies who think they can continue just treating diseases, not curing diseases, they will disappear. We need to start to cure diseases. It's just not good enough to sort of declare a disease chronic and just treat it for 30, 40 years, you know, because it's even commercially not viable. Because if you are not better with your new compound than another company that already treats just symptoms, and now you come with another, with a new compound maybe that also just treats symptoms, it's quite unlikely that you will really be better than standard of care. So we would need to move from treating symptoms to actually treating causes of disease and thereby be able to cure. So there may be cases where we don't have yet the compounds that we need. So maybe there is a target protein, but we don't have the compound for that yet. Okay, then you have to find a new compound. Or there may be a compound on the market, but its profile may not be optimal. So it's maybe as a tablet, it's not resorbed very well, or the half-life is too short, and so forth. Okay, then you need a better version of that compound, which you maybe take only once a day, yeah, and it's better resolved. But the potential for this repurposing is amazing. Mm-hmm. And because what we see is a beta blocker compound, you know, is not only binding to beta receptors. It's been analyzed that a small molecule that is currently on the market binds in average to 32 other proteins, because a beta blocker, of course, does not see, oh, there is a beta receptor, let's bind to it. All small molecules need to bind to a little pocket in a protein. So it's either a deeper pocket or a shallower pocket or a hydrophilic pocket or a hydrophobic pocket or a mix of that. And thereby the compound fits in there. But if the same pocket appears on another protein, of course it will bind there. Yeah. Because it needs this pocket. And that's a whole research discipline by now. They call it the pocketome. Mm-hmm. And the estimate is that there are basically, the range is from 1600 to 2,500 different pockets on all our proteins. Mm-hmm. So you can only develop 2,500 different compounds for different pockets. That's it. So it is predictable that drug discovery will come to an end. We will not eternally need to discover new compounds. I mean, a few optimizations here and there, I won't exclude that, but we will not eternally need new compounds.
That's drug discovery, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But then what some step you need to get into the environment, the clinical environment, and there's a regulatory environment, and there's a health system organized by organs. There are, you know, ICD codes coding diseases and not modules, as you say, and as you demand and suggest. So what is your advice, like, and how should a pharma company deal with that, with that problem?
Yeah, the regulators in the first place are very much on our side. There is actually an initiative from four leading countries in Europe: Spain, Portugal, Norway, and Sweden. They have formed the REPOC group, so repurposing probably. And they strongly support these efforts, you know, by giving regulatory advice and opening doors for you and making it as easy as possible. From a commercial point of view, the hurdle that I see is the reimbursement. This is what we have identified. You know, the science, it sounds a little bit arrogant, but the science is more or less clear. We have so many successes now in an Alzheimer's subtype, in two cancers, and so forth. It really works. The approach works. But let's say if you have, in the end, a statin, a beta blocker, and indomitacin, and they work in the subtype of Alzheimer. And so you need to invest some money, you need to do a reformulation, maybe different doses, you need to do clinical trials and so forth. And now you want to have a little bit of more reimbursement than those three compounds currently cost on the market for their current use. And then the legal system is in a way that the HTA officers are obliged to make sure that this therapy is available to the patient for the lowest possible cost. So they could say, well, indomitacin is on the market, the beta blocker is on the market, the statin is on the market, the therapy costs €4.50 per month. Here you go.
Yeah.
We will reimburse you with €4.50.
Yeah.
Then, of course, that's not sustainable. Of course, you don't want that companies claim, no, we want €4,500 for this per month. That's also unethical, yeah? But somehow we have to find a way that health technology assessors can define a fair price for this new indication, because new research, new investments, and so forth went into it. And it's obviously also better for the patient to have one formulation with all three compounds in the optimal dose combined, as opposed to sort of do cherry picking every morning and then make sure they pick the right three tablets. That is the biggest obstacle for us. And there are, Norway is basically leading this initiative. We are doing policy events now every January in Brussels, because it's, for a scientist, a little bit strange, but it's a political decision that needs to be made. Here are very precise, very effective, curative drugs that are very affordable, but they need reasonable, fair pricing for a reasonable return on investment. So it could be a win-win-win situation, but our entire sort of regulatory and reimbursement system is geared towards new compounds with patents and basically new compounds for which you can ask more or less every price. We can also patent. That's not the problem. We can patent our therapies, the combinations. These are very often also reformulations. We also combine it very often with a diagnostic. So the IP protection is not the issue. It is really only the later reimbursement.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as you said, like it's also you know, there will be still room for new potential drugs. It's just that, you know, you need to to see the combination, the modules, the networks, and then based on that, make a targeted research and see what's already on the market, how you can combine existing products with maybe also new compounds and new developments. However, still, it sounds like quite revolutionary. It sounds like the system is not made for it. And it sounds like actually this calls for a change of the business model, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what you mentioned, for instance, that the clinicians that we interact with, it's a little bit too disruptive, for instance. So we have, for instance, one mechanism and one therapy with which we can treat heart failure. We can treat a subtype of dementia. We can treat hypertension and we can prevent stroke. Of course, if I now do a study with a cardiologist, I have to say, here is a new therapy for a subtype of heart failure. I don't mention the other ones because that's confusing. But the disease definition is actually no longer heart failure, hypertension, stroke, or whatsoever. It is this molecular mechanism, this module. Yeah.
And this is, I think, is the opportunity for the pharma companies, right? Once you have a compound in your hands, right, which is that powerful, and we see, you know, some of that, you know, already happening with the GLP-1s and so on, right? Which is very clear already that it's not just one indication which can be treated with them. Like started with diabetes, now we're at obesity, and then now we're talking about even, you know, further
dementia,
you know, a lot. So once you have a compound in your hands, you know, the potential is huge, right? And the potential is not linear, right? You need new formulations. For some, you need new dosages. For some, you need research also. Some of them, you also need new combinations. So it's not easy and simple, but it, you know, already would accelerate the development of new compounds across all indications on a module basis tremendously. And I think this is the reason, I guess, and then you can talk maybe at the end a bit about that research that you also do, which is supported by the European Union, right?
Yeah, thank you. So the European Union, you can criticize as much as you want it, but they are surprisingly, how shall I say, disruptive very often in the calls and in the directions they say we want to go. So they are supporting this with 50 million euros for two projects. In our project, we built a European-wide platform with all the tools you could possibly need, from bioinformatics, preclinical models, patent strategies, freedom to operate strategies, business development strategies, regulatory, HTA. So there will be tools online for every possible question you have along the line. If you want to do it yourself, or you can also use it as a matchmaking. If you want for certain aspects along this line, a partner, this can also be done. And so that's called Repo4EU, R-E-P-O. For and then .eu, and the platform will go live in next year towards the end. And we have a conference every year. Next one is in Barcelona in September. It's called the Rexpo conference, where all these disciplines come together. So not only some crazy scientists or bioinformatician, we have all these disciplines, you know, even business developer, IP people, pharma companies there, because we need to discuss things together, you know, think it from the end, basically. Yeah,
that's what I like. If you think it from the end, you know, what's your statement like 10 years from now? Where do we stand with this?
10 years from now, medicine will have radically changed. We will be able to cure most of the diseases. Cure. And I also would predict that it will become the most normal thing that, at least in industrialized countries, that basically upon birth, you get your genome sequenced. And then with this better understanding of diseases beyond single genes and single proteins because of these networks, everyone will know what their real medical risk profile is. And if we know with this risk, this therapy would cure you, then we will enter a new area of prevention. I think this is the real real sort of innovation that we will see, that we will able to prevent diseases. So we may treat people because there is solid genetic and biomarker evidence that there is this disease risk. It's slowly progressing so that people will be treated for their disease risks even before they ever have their own symptom. Why should we wait that someone gets asthma and then we quickly treat him if we can genetically diagnose, well, you've got this clear risk for asthma. We are following this biomarker. We are starting now this therapy, and this patient will never have a single asthma attack.
So, and that would be the time when ultimately the health system deserves.
Exactly. So we move from a, as I call it, sick care system to a health care system.
Exactly. And then, you know, if you ask me, this is a super nice vision. Are there any risks attached to the process? Is there anything we need to pay attention on from your perspective? Other than, I mean, data protection, data security. And
I think it is mainly the reimbursement, really. Without being a business, no one will invest.
Well, thank you very much. Super insightful. Very good discussion. Super transformative topic. And there's more to come. And, you know, thank you very much for updating us on that very important research.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Business Insights by Roland Berger. Roland Berger is a leading global strategy consultancy. Our full-line service portfolio spans across all key industries and business functions. Established in 1967 in Munich, we are renowned for driving transformation, innovation, and business performance around the world. For more information, visit our website at rolandberger.com.